You know, some guy was like, oh, I want to see naked women today and get vegan food, and I don't have time to make two stops. Welcome to Casa Diablo.
That's right. Today on the show, we end up at a vegan strip club in Portland, Oregon. Plus, more tales from Portlandia and a visit to the Modernist Cuisine Lab in Seattle. We bring you today's show from the road in the Pacific Northwest. Oh, and we have a new theme song. I can't wait to hear what you think. From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleinman, and this is Good Food.
So, here we go.
No one understands egg yolks the way you do.
I want to speak to the person in charge of the cooking program.
I'm Evan Kleinman.
Leave the gun. Take the canola.
The inspiration for this week's show came when Sherry Yard, baker and pastry chef extraordinaire, invited me on a road trip to the Kneading Conference West. Basically, it's a geek fest for bread bakers that happens once a year in Washington State. Long story short, my producer Jillian decided to come along too, and a rollicking adventure ensued. I'll let her explain how we ended up at the world's only vegan strip club in Portland, Oregon.
According to the ultimate strip club list, Portland, Oregon has one strip club for every 9,578 residents. This statistic means that Portland, Oregon has more strip clubs per capita than any other major U.S. city. Coincidentally, Portland also has the highest vegan population in the country. So in the spirit of when in Rome, I scheduled a field trip for Evan Kleinman, Sherry Yard, and me to visit Casa Diablo, the world's only vegan strip club situated on a sketchy industrial stretch of Northwest Portland. When we pulled up in our bright white minivan rental car, there were three dancers on the poles, dancing to Stevie Nicks' The Chain. And from the look of it, none of the customers were there for the food. Johnny Zucle goes by the name Johnny Diablo, a name he says was given to him by the vegan gods. He's the owner of this fine establishment. He's well over 6 feet tall and looks more like a bouncer at an L.A. strip club than a vegan restaurateur. But he's been vegan for 29 years, and this is not his first vegan restaurant. Before Casa Diablo opened in 2008, he tried his hand at a pirate-themed vegan restaurant called Pirate's Tavern in the same location. But he says that the local truckers who frequent the neighborhood were confused by his menu.
I mean, I swear, they'd come in and they go, tofu? What the hell's that? I go, dude, man, it's awesome. Just try it. You're going to love it. If you don't like it, I'll pay for it. They'd look at it and sniff it. And they're so scared. They go, you know what? I'll come back later. And they would run. Every day, some big burly dude would come in here and freaking be such a wuss that he would run. And so I said, you know what? What is the one thing that would work here? It's like, oh, you know what? I got to get these guys to come in. What do they want? They want to see pretty girls. So I mixed pretty girls with awesome vegan food, and now we are the number one strip club, not only in Portland, but in the Pacific Northwest.
Do you think that's because of the vegan food?
You know what? I think it is. You know, it all started it. Because we're vegan, people came on, oh, I got to check this place out. They came out and they go, this place is awesome. I mean, we have over 100 dancers here every week. 30 tonight, and they are gorgeous.
At this point, a waitress stops by to ask if we're doing okay. She's topless, wearing only a thong and high heels, yet smiling politely at us. She's holding a cocktail tray, as if we're at TGI Fridays. So we ordered a drink, and Johnny insists that we try some of the food.
Hey, can you put an order of just a Diablo burger and cut it in quarters? Taquitos, toast, maybe some samosas or egg rolls.
We'd already eaten dinner, so we just ordered the black bean burger and a few drinks, and we continued our conversation.
Are most of your strippers vegan?
No. I got a few vegans, some vegetarians, and most aren't. But, man, I sure try to educate them. You can't force somebody to do something they don't want to, so all I can do is just put the information out there like I'm giving it to you.
Can they wear leather products?
You can't wear any animal products on stage. No wool, no silk, no fur. You know silk? You know how they make silk? They boil silkworms alive so they don't chew out of their cocoon. We're atrocious to all animal life and insects. We're just mean.
Johnny loves to use the word atrocious to describe what we do to animals. But let's address the elephant in the room here. Isn't there something equally atrocious about putting young, beautiful, naked women on a pole?
You know, here's what I usually hear. You won't exploit animals, but you exploit women, right? Well, guess what? Okay, this might be exploiting women, but what happens to animals is not exploitation. It's murder. It's torture and murder. Exploitation of an animal would be like somebody has a poodle and then they put it in a show and they whirl them around a show, it's cute, and they win a prize. That's exploiting that animal. Well, the women here, nobody owns them and is, you know, like that. They're doing it because they want to do it. They're all here because they want to make, they make so much money. It's really, they're exploiting the customers.
No matter what you think about Johnny's ideas on exploitation, he's right about the money. Strippers at Casa Diablo stay there because your average 9-to-5 is not nearly as lucrative.
I'm a pastry chef. I went to school at Le Cordon Bleu, so I have an associate's degree in everything.
That's Dollface. She has a face to match her name. She's been working at Casa Diablo for 5 years. She explained to us how she ended up there.
I was working at UPS when I was 18. My mom's a driver there. So she got me the job, and then I moved up here, and then I wasn't making enough money. I was making like $150 a week. So I just like researched different places in town. This was the first place I called, and I came over. And they hired me that day, and I worked that night.
The money that Dollface made dancing at Casa Diablo enabled her to go to culinary school. She tried working at a bakery for a while, but the money just didn't compare. So she stayed at Diablo and started selling vegan muffins and pastries for the strip club.
Earlier this week, I made a martini glass Oreo parfait. So it's made out of, I call it vegan pastry cream, but it's like a concoction I made that is very, very similar to pastry cream. And then coconut milk as whipped cream and Oreos.
Vegan pastries are not her forte. But she says the girls, her fellow dancers, like them. For Dollface, the end goal is to be a cake decorator in San Diego, where she's moving with her boyfriend. But an hourly wage at a cake shop? That's a tough match for the money she makes now as a dancer. The big question is whether or not she'll be able to leave the stripping life behind.
I don't know. It's going to be very hard to see what to do. It's just like the atmosphere. It's very different from anything else. We're all take care of each other. When somebody needs a place to stay, you always offer it. It's like that kind of family. I love it here.
It was almost time for Dollface to dance, so we said our goodbyes and let her finish getting ready. As for Johnny, he's just enjoying the ride. Next month, he'll open a second vegan strip club across town called Johnny Diablo's Black Cauldron. It's pirate-themed and set to open on Halloween. Cory Booker, the Newark mayor and Senate hopeful, recently thrust Casa Diablo into the national spotlight when he flirted on Twitter with one of the club's resident strippers. His spokesman responded to the controversy by saying, quote, "The most shocking part of the story was learning that there's a vegan strip club in Portland." Before we left, I asked Johnny to leave us with some parting words of vegan wisdom.
Vixen's not veal. Sizzle not steak. We put the meat on the pole, not on the plate.
For Good Food, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
Up next, we've got a more PG overview of Portland Eats. Stick around for a taste of baked potato ice cream and everyone's favorite dirty bird, pigeon.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more. All in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Portland may have the most vegans and strip clubs per capita, but my unofficial research indicates it also definitely has to have the most artisanal food businesses per capita. Salt and Straw Ice Cream is one of the many upstarts that began from a humble food cart and grew into a thriving business. we stopped by to see cousins and co-owners Kim and Tyler Malik, whose story I think will be sure to inspire the food entrepreneur in you.
We had a little food cart, and it was on the patio outside of a really amazing restaurant called Aviary, and they were nice enough to let us park out there. And Tyler was driving ice cream back and forth, I think, on the top of his Subaru. And we were learning, you know, kind of getting our sea legs under us. And it was such a cool way to get to know the neighborhood and our customers and get feedback on our product and really establish ourselves before we opened up the street on Alberta later that summer.
So during that period of time when you were just operating off a cart, where did you actually make the ice cream?
There's a cool place in Portland called the Food Innovation Center, and it's a collaboration between the Oregon Department of Agriculture and the local university system, and they help incubate and get new food companies off the grounds if they're going to be using local produce. And so it's a really great sustainable way to, you know, help support our local farmers by helping new food companies get off the ground.
That is really a great idea. I wish we had that in California. That's very cool. And Tyler, I understand that you spent some time in China studying and then traveling throughout Asia. Did that time that you spent there influence the way that you approach flavor?
Yeah, it was incredibly inspiring. And also just kind of the way we approach how we interact with people and just seeing, like, being able to look at communities in Asia and how when they work together, we kind of say all ships rise. And it's really cool to be able to see maybe in a smaller village how it's super important, but also in Portland, it's become really important. So
one of my favorite stories along those lines, Tyler had this fond memory of waking up one night on the train in Thailand by a conductor who was offering this special sundae. It was a sticky rice ice cream sundae, and he always wanted to recreate that. And so before we even existed, we called Andy Ricker, who had just won a James Beard Award, and said, you know, could we buy your sticky rice? And he said, yeah, I don't want to sell my sticky rice. That seems really hard. But if you want to come to my kitchen, Tyler, I'll teach you how to make it.
That is really generous. Really, really generous. And I know that that spirit of community generosity is really important to the two of you.
Yes.
So let's talk about the story of chef collaboration, because that's really fascinating for me. I have to, of course, go straight to the flavor that you did with Michael Votaccio, because he doesn't live up here. He's in L.A. First, why don't you describe the end result that you made?
Yeah, so we created a baked potato ice cream loaded with candies. And that's where we started in the whole brainstorming process. And Michael and I just started bouncing ideas off of each other, just like, well, what if we make the ice cream like this with potatoes and use the nature of the potatoes to stabilize it. Like, we started using cheddar cheese in the cookie dough to create like that sense of cheddar cheese sprinkled on top. Bacon and like a bacon Oreo cookie.
And what's really funny is you taste that ice cream and you say, this is so Michael Votaccio.
That's a good point. We wanted to use this chef series collaboration to kind of get a feel for the chef's cooking techniques and philosophies through ice cream. So that was the idea behind it. So I'm glad to hear you say that.
One Portland-based chef who collaborated with Salt and Straw is Jen Lewis. You may know her from this season's Top Chef Masters. She's also the chef and owner of Lincoln and Sunshine Tavern in Portland. Jen, you had one of the most interesting ice cream flavors in the rotation, and I'm really happy I get to talk to you about your inspiration.
Thanks so much. It was a really fun collaboration. I know Tyler real well. I know how he thinks about food, and it's really fun because whenever we sit down, I've got something in my head, and I'm already very decisive on what I want. And I always sit down, he opens his notebook, and he's got these flow charts and these circles and these words because he's really creative. And I looked at him, I looked at the paper, I said, that looks great. I said, but what I want to do is I want to do sea urchin ice cream with mint and chilies.
Now, my understanding was, talking to Tyler, that the uni isn't in the ice cream, it's in a meringue.
Yeah, and that's all Tyler, and I thought that was really cool. The first ice cream, I don't think he did that, and then he decided to put it the sea urchin in with some kind of texture, which I think always breaks up some of the same flavor. And then you can get different bites. So once you have one bite of the ice cream and another bite, one might have the meringue, one might not, and the flavor is really different. And I think that's really lovely when you eat a plate of food, so why shouldn't it be the same in ice cream? Sea urchin is also often thought about as texture, which is 100% right, but it also has this roundness of flavor. And so sometimes it's wonderful to taste both of those, and sometimes it's nice to isolate one or the other.
Now, leaving salt and straw for a minute, but still staying with ice cream, I understand that you put Fernet, the Amaro, on top of ice cream.
We do. I love Amaros. We make a Nocino from the walnuts from my front yard tree, from green walnuts. And we make ice cream at both of our restaurants. At Sunshine, it is a honey soft serve, and we put that into a dish, and we put Fernet Branca over the top.
Now, I think it's so interesting because when I think of the whole world of Amaros, to me, Fernet Branca is the one that if you're in Italy and you really are experiencing digestive distress, that is the one that they're going to give you. It is the one of the Amaroist.
Yeah, it is. We call it fuerte. I agree. I think that it's the most popular in Portland. Maybe it's the gateway. It's a gateway to Amaros. But I think that that's something that people really enjoy, and they know it by name. And if we can get them hooked in one way, then they'll start trying others.
I have to try that. It sounds so interesting. Thank you very much, Jen.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming.
That was Chef Jen Lewis talking about her chef collaboration ice cream with Kim and Tyler Malik at Salt and Straw. You can find Salt and Straw's ice creams at Jones on 3rd in West Hollywood. Plus, Tyler gives us a sneak peek at their holiday flavors due out this fall.
You know, for November in particular, we kind of took inspiration from, like, what's on a Thanksgiving dinner? What's on your plate? And so, you know, we created a stuffing ice cream with celery soda as, like, the flavoring. And we created like a pumpkin pie ice cream with Chev. On top of it all, we've got this one where we're making a turkey fat caramel ice cream and then frying up turkey skin and folding it into a brittle. So it's a turkey skin brittle, and it actually tastes like this really delicious caramelized turkey.
Yep, that's no joke though. Turkey caramel ice cream with turkey crackling brittle. Can't believe it, is coming to a store near you. We'll have all the flavors and details on where you can run out and grab it for yourself on the Good Food blog. You can't take a trip to Portland, Oregon these days without at least one meal at Le Pigeon. Chef Gabriel Rucker is an unapologetic chef. He cooks bold flavors with just the right amount of restraint. And lucky for us, he just came out with a beautiful new cookbook. It's called Le Pigeon, Cooking at the Dirty Bird. We stopped by his restaurant just as they were preparing for dinner service to find out what the deal is with the Dirty Bird.
Well, this restaurant has kind of always a stigma about it, people saying, how do you say their name? Is it Le Pigeon? Is it Le Pigeon? Is it The Pigeon? And so I got tired of the question, so I just say it's the Dirty Bird, because, you know, New Yorkers would come in and they would say, you know, really, Le Pigeon? I hate pigeons. You know, why would you name your restaurant Le Pigeon? And it's like, pigeon's the dirty bird, but it's delicious. Sometimes, you know, dirty, pretty things, right? So that just, it's a name that stuck, and we were going back and forth on what to call the restaurant, and sometimes the first thing that pops into your mind is the best thing.
It's hilarious, because what do people think when they're eating squab? They don't think they're eating pigeon?
We call it pigeon because we're Le Pigeon, and that's what it is. I guess squab is just a name that was invented to trick people into what they're really eating.
I have to say that often when I get a chef's cookbook, I'm not surprised by it necessarily, knowing a little bit about the chef. The minute I opened your book and I started really going through it, then I had to go back and I had to start actually reading the words. The way that you use the kind of sort of super dude kind of ingredients, a lot of heavy meat, the use of game, the use of foie gras, is presented in really surprising ways. And in the book, ways that I think are actually possible for a cook at home to do, which I think is rare.
There's a certain sense of ego and pride, you know, in what we do. And in writing a cookbook that's not a coffee table cookbook like an 11 Madison Park, or you have to check that at the door, because I'm writing a cookbook for all the people that are listening to this show to actually make some of the recipes. We do include some recipes in this that we called FU recipes. That was just because I wanted them to be in my book, because this is also something that's going to be around for me to show my kids and everything. So they're the ones for like the serious people that are like, you know, I got my weekend, I'm going to make this recipe. And it takes a weekend, you know.
Give me an example of an FU dish.
The foie gras with the eel pot au feu. You have to make a consommé. I mean, have you ever made a consommé at home? You guys have a whole radio show about food. Have you made consommé at home that often?
I've made consommé in a restaurant, but never at home, no.
I have never made consommé at home either, for the record. That or like a veal tête de veau. We have a tête de veau dish that involves like the roasting of an entire veal head. I had a hard time sourcing a veal head with the brain in it and everything still intact. Some stuff is just good literature. Some stuff is good for you to cook it at home. And that's what we wanted to do. So those are two FU dishes. The rabbit pie one, the smoked rabbit pie, is a little bit of an FU dish, but it's definitely worth making.
I don't know. Smoked rabbit pie sounds pretty accessible to me. How do you go about smoking the rabbit?
Well, first we braise the rabbit hindquarters, and then we put them in a Little Chief smoker, which you can buy at like a Big Five Sporting Goods or G.I. Joe's is what we have up here. And then we shred the meat, and then we cook it down with bacon and cream and onions. Then we make the pastry shell with cheddar cheese and leaf lard, of course. And then we serve it with a hot mustard ice cream.
My goodness. Okay, we're having a laugh fest here now. And then we serve it with hot mustard ice cream.
Sweet hot mustard ice cream, to be exact.
Beaver mustard.
Yep.
Oh, that is just fantastic. Okay, so beaver mustard, some people are just total aficionados for it. Tell me about the mustard, and then a little bit go through the process of how you build an ice cream from it.
Well, I fell in love with mustard when I was a kid because I like was one of those kids that if mayonnaise even looked at my sandwich, I wouldn't eat it. So I was a mustard kid. I loved like those sweet hot mustard. There's one called Napa Valley Mustard Company, which found its way into my fridge somehow. And I was a latchkey kid, so I made my own sandwiches when I got home from school, and I would explore all the mustards that we had at the house. Because mustard's one of those things, like someone will give it to you as a gift, and then, I mean, you guys probably have refrigerators with random condiments that have stayed in there forever. So as a latchkey kid making my own food, I would explore those condiments. And I fell in love with mustard. We actually brought the mustard in for a different dish that's in this book, which is our pork with the pretzel spetzel. And so we were using that. And that was right around the time we were exploring, kind of getting into using the savory ice creams. And I just would put that mustard on everything. And I just looked over at my pastry chef at the time and said, this would make a really interesting ice cream. And that's how the dish started, was with the ice cream. And then it was like, what would we serve that with? Let's serve it with pie a la mode. So we smoked rabbit pie with all cheddar over the top of it and the ice cream, and then rabbit heart chutney, and it kind of happened.
See, I love that because you can really see how a chef's mind works. Most people would say, okay, you're going to start with this beautiful rabbit. Somebody delivered a rabbit to the restaurant. But no, it started with mustard and ice cream, and then worked back from there. That's so great. Gabriel, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, guys.
Gabriel Rucker is chef and owner of Le Pigeon in Portland, Oregon. His new book is Le Pigeon, Cooking at the Dirty Bird. Now I'm going to challenge you to make one of his FU recipes. Find the rabbit pie with sweet hot mustard ice cream on the Good Food blog. Sounds weird, but oddly delicious. Up next, we'll head north to the beautiful rolling hills of the Skagit Valley in Washington State. Stay with us.
Ever wish you could hear KCRW's signature music programming wherever and whenever you want? You can with Eclectic 24. Our ever-expanding all-music stream is available worldwide 24/7 online. You can listen to KCRW's diverse music mix on the go or in the car through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out. Go to kcrw.com/eclectic24.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Washington's Skagit Valley is about an hour north of Seattle and just 15 minutes inland from Skagit Bay. Each year, thousands of tourists visit the valley to see tulips. There are hundreds of acres of them in bloom each year, every April. But lesser known are the 15,000 to 20,000 acres of organic wheat grown here. Now, to a trader, wheat is a commodity. To a baker, it's flour.
But what can wheat be to a small farmer? Dr. Stephen Jones is the director of the Plant Breeding Department at Washington State University's Mount Vernon campus here in the Skagit Valley. He's also spearheading the Kneading Conference West, a grain conference that brought us here today. I asked him to tell us how he found his way to the Skagit Valley.
Well, I was a commodity wheat breeder for about 20 years, and what that means is that the only thing I was concerned with is developing new varieties of wheat that yielded as much as possible, had a certain color for the flower, which was brilliant white, and made a huge volume of the loaf size was a very high volume. Became disenchanted with that after a while, when I thought there was a little more in terms of bread and flour and wheat and things like that. And I didn't like the idea of someone in Kansas City, Minneapolis, or Chicago telling farmers what their product was worth, which is exactly how commodity system works, is someone else tells you what your crop is worth, you try to get rid of it. So in eastern Washington, there's 2.5 million acres of wheat. It basically all goes down the river and is exported from the country. It's a true commodity. Here, we're trying to add value to that, to this, give a name to this sort of faceless, soulless product, which is tons of wheat. If there are 60 million acres of wheat in this country, and there are, and it's all bred for the same purpose, which is a white bread, plastic wrap white bread, then it becomes self-fulfilling. You get white flour at the store because that's what the commodity people want. That's not what the serious home baker or the craft baker wants. They might want stone milled, they probably do. They may also want a wheat that's blue or black or yellow or whatever color, and we can do that. We're working on breeding wheat varieties for Alaska. We also send wheat to Hawaii that can be grown up on the hills. My father grew up in LA, and there were a lot of farms there back then. LA's a great place to grow wheat. It takes the right variety. So the variety that you're going to grow in LA might be quite different than what we grow up in Skagit Valley or certainly Alaska or upstate New York. So we're working with LA bread bakers directly. We love the challenge of breeding wheat for diverse underserved areas like this.
Dr. Stephen Jones is the director of the Plant Breeding Department at Washington State University's Mount Vernon campus in the Skagit Valley. We've been talking to him from the Kneading Conference West, a yearly grain conference here in the Skagit Valley. Check out my Facebook page for a link to an article about the work Dr. Jones is doing with Dan Barber at Blue Hill Stone Barns. Dan recently brought together a group of chefs from around the world to make a case for changing the way chefs think about seeds. Dr. Jones was his keynote speaker. I'd love to hear what you think about it. Leave a comment and let me know. I don't know about you. I have a sense that I'm not alone in this. I find it very difficult to get sufficiently inspired to do the kind of exercise I know it's good for me. But when I saw this spin bike attached to a grain mill, I thought I may have found the perfect combination for me to finally get on that bike. Jack Jenkins is founder of Country Living Productions, the manufacturer of the Country Living Grain Mill. Hi.
Well, hi. I love your problem because we have the perfect solution.
I just somehow think that if I'm on a bike and I know I have to have a cup of flour to make a little bit of pancake batter, that I'm much more likely to get on it than if I have this abstract notion of wanting to be healthier, thinner.
Absolutely. It's such a great thing. You can do three things at once. You can read while you exercise, you can grind flour at the same time, and you can get some weight loss if you wish, and you're going to get good food.
Could you describe the grain mill? What is the action that grinds the grain?
All right. We have a large flywheel with a V-groove in it. We have carbon steel grinding plates that is gravity feed, so we have the wheat in the hopper above the plates, and as we turn that flywheel, that grinds it, and we can grind flour that is extraordinarily fine, finer than any grain mill I've ever seen. In fact, it's almost fairy dust if you want it, but you can adjust it.
But what I find most intriguing is this aspect of connecting the grain mill to an exercise bike.
Yes.
How did you get the idea to take off the bike chain and attach a belt to turn the flywheel of the mill?
Okay, in this particular case, we don't have a bike. We started with an Exercycle. It has a large cast iron flywheel. It's heavy. And that's nice because once you get going, you can relax a couple of seconds and it'll just keep going without you pedaling. So we didn't have to take a chain off. We just added a pulley to the hub, put our belt on it, put our grain mill in front of it on a piece of wood, and do what we do now.
I think I should try it.
I think you should try it, too. You ready?
It's a blast. I mean, you can actually feel like you're accomplishing something rather than just, you know, I don't know, getting sweaty or some abstract notion that you're actually going to lose weight. And this is much better because, you know, maybe it's a zero-sum game, you know. You can know that you're going to have this beautiful flour, you're going to make some pancakes or a muffin or some bread or some pasta, but you've, you know, expended the energy to do it. And so, you know, input output, it's perfect. Thank you so much.
Jack Jenkins is the founder of Country Living Productions and manufacturer of The Grain Mill. Check out a video of the grain mill Exercycle in action on the Good Food blog.
So we've been talking about wheat and flour. What else does every baker need? Aside from water, you kind of need an oven. And many of us have the fantasy of building a wood oven in our backyard. I was lucky enough to spend the morning with Kiko Denzer, learning the process myself with several other people. It's so interesting how eminently doable it is. Kiko has several YouTube videos, he has a blog, and also a book called Build Your Own Earth Oven. Hi, Kiko.
Hi.
Most of our listeners, or a great part of our listeners, are in Southern California. So we're in an urban environment. We have neighbors close by. Is it something we can actually do and operate in a situation such as ourselves?
Yes. One of the beauties and one of the benefits of a wood-fired oven is that it reconnects you to a traditional source of fire, right? And traditional peoples know how to burn wood. And they know that you don't burn wet wood. And they also have a sense of, you know, what's going on with smoke and heat and everything else like that. So there are ways to burn a fire that are smokier and ways that are cleaner. And the best thing to do with your neighbors is invite them over for a pizza party. So they understand that it's not just smoke coming out of your backyard, but that you're cooking and that it's, you know, sort of normal activity.
And is this a process that takes weeks and we need to have a multi-hours long commitment to be able to do it?
You can do it quickly. If you can gather a bunch of people, you can do it in a weekend. And actually, I did one with a lady from Sunset Magazine, and the requirements were that we did it in a day. From the ground to the finished oven was a day. And that is eminently doable. It takes a little bit of prep and planning. On the other hand, it makes a lot of sense to stage it so you do a little bit at a time. You know, so you make your mix one day, you make your foundation another day. But, it, you know, it's a little bit like bread. You can schedule it so that it fits your life instead of scheduling your life to fit your oven.
And what kind of materials are we talking about? Are we talking about a masonry oven, a brick oven?
Masonry comes from the same root as the word to make. So a masonry oven is an oven you make. So on a more technical level, most people think of bricks and block, right, as masonry. But bricks are made out of dirt from underfoot, literally. And most towns that have brick traditionally, or, you know, from way back when before they transported everything thousands of miles, would have a clay pit where they would dig their clay and turn it into bricks. So with the oven, what you're doing is simplifying the process, because instead of making it into brick and then making it into an oven, you're just making it straight into an oven. And when you burn the fire, it transforms the clay into a soft, low-fired brick.
Where do we get the clay?
Under your feet.
Well, I happen to know that in my front yard, I have nothing but clay under my feet. But for people who maybe have a different type of soil, maybe folks who live closer to the coastal areas, what do they do?
Clay is the most common building material on the planet. So anywhere you go, there's probably clay nearby. You may not have it directly underfoot. I think it's fun looking around for it. I mean, once you start to develop an affinity for the material, you pick up dirt everywhere you go and you play with it and you spit on it and you see what it looks like. And, you know, it's like, oh, wow, there's a construction site. Oh, that's beautiful clay. I'm going to get some of that. And, you know, they'll give you a pickup load or a bucket load. Some people are really either strapped for time or literally can't find clay anywhere nearby. And then you can buy clay, and you don't actually need very much, because we're making a mix that's part clay and mostly sand, generally anywhere from half to three-quarters sand.
What role does the clay play in the role of the oven?
It's sticky stuff that you can build with, but then when you fire it, it goes through transformation, and it becomes this other material, which is no longer water-soluble. It stores heat. And it radiates that heat back into the oven slowly. Is really, it's a perfect vehicle for baking, because what you end up with is a hot chamber that radiates heat into the food the way the sun radiates heat. So even on a cold day, you're warm. It's very different kind of heat than from a conventional oven, which is just heating the air. So the mass of the earth is actually providing the heat for the cooking. And because it's a closed space, then you also get a concentration of steam, which keeps your food moist. It gives your bread the good crust. It does all the things that it can't do in a conventional oven, because a conventional oven has to vent that, because in order to maintain the heat, it has to keep heating air, and the air has to keep moving through the oven. So it dries food out.
Kiko, I'm thinking about doing this myself in my backyard, and in an area where I would put it, where it's all concrete on the ground. My next door neighbor has trees coming up. Not super leafy trees, but trees. How do we want to site the oven to keep it as safe as possible?
Well, that's a good question. And, you know, carefully. In a more urban area, you want to have a chimney on the oven, because that'll get the smoke out of your face. And, you know, when the wind and the climate conditions are such that everything wants to sink down in the yard, you want to get the smoke out. And that'll also help with your neighbor's trees, because, you know, you build it in a place where the chimney has some clearance.
So let's talk about food, don't you think?
I think so. It's lunchtime.
Now, most people think of these ovens as being pizza ovens or flatbread ovens. What's the difference between using them for a pizza oven and using them to bake other things like bread or a tart, something like that?
So pizza typically wants a live fire, and the pizza comes out of this oven, you know, in a minute, 60 seconds. If you're not paying attention, they're toast. But it's nice, because if you've got a lot of people to feed, you can give them a lot of pizza quickly. For most other foods, you don't need a live fire, so then you're relying on the battery. So you clean out all the embers and all the coals and all the flame, and the heat that's stored in the masonry is what cooks your food. And if you have a well-insulated oven, you can have cooking temperatures for 2 days easily after the fire. So anything you can cook in the oven.
Thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
That was Kiko Denzer. He's the go-to guy for DIY earth ovens. We'll have links to all his books, including Build Your Own Earth Oven, on the Good Food blog. And now, it wouldn't be good food without a market report. So we're going to head to the local farmer's market in Mount Vernon, Washington, to find out what's in season right now in the Pacific Northwest. I'm here at the Mount Vernon Farmers Market with Farmer Kai Ottison from Headland Farms. They're in Laconer, Washington. Hi, Kai.
Good morning.
How far away from where we are now is Laconer?
It's about 10 miles west of Mount Vernon, and we're about a mile from the mouth of the Skagit River.
And what kind of crops do you grow?
We grow mixed vegetable crops and about an acre of greenhouse and high tunnel crops, tomatoes, peppers, eggplant, as well as about you know, close to 60 different crops out in the field.
How many acres do you farm?
So we farm about 400 acres altogether. About 40 acres of that is in row crops for the fresh market garden.
I understand that a big part of what you do is farm seed.
That's correct. Cabbage seed, hybrid cabbage seed, spinach seed, and beet seed in a given year. It's a tremendously well-suited region for seed production. We have fairly consistently warm, dry summers when the seed is being harvested, and the winters are cool enough for the plants to go through their overwintering period to vernalize, but not so cold that they freeze out. So we're not growing heads here. We're growing them specifically for the seed. So you have to get them to not head up, and then for that seed spike to bolt and set seed going into the spring.
So walking through a field that is geared towards seed must look completely different than what most of us think of when we think about walking through a farm.
That's correct. You're basically trying to get the plant to do what a farmer growing it as a crop is trying to avoid, is have it bolt or go to seed, which is generally not the most edible, flavorful iteration of that plant.
So given that your family is so involved in making all this cabbage seed, I would imagine that you grow a fair amount of cabbage for the family. What do you like to do with it?
I like a coleslaw with one of my favorites is pretty standard in terms of the ingredients. So carrots, apples, pecans are nice. But then I'll use an aioli and a little candied ginger.
Thank you so much, Kai.
Thank you. You're welcome.
That was Kai Ottison. He's a farmer here in the Skagit Valley. We met him at the Mount Vernon Farmers Market. Here at the Mount Vernon Farmers Market, like many farmers markets, there's music. So we're being serenaded while we talk to Bev Lenning, a berry farmer here in the Skagit Valley.
Hi there.
So, Bev, I have to say, when we first came up to your stand and we saw the blackberries that literally were as big as a finger, bigger than a finger, we were just overwhelmed. Does your family specialize in berries?
Yes, that's what we do. We have a retail stand called the Berry Barn, just because that's what we do. So we have like 28 varieties of different berries. And it starts with strawberries and ends with blueberries and strawberries and blackberries. That's the end. So in between, we have boysenberries, blackberries, cantata blackberries, gooseberries, red currants, black currants, jostaberries. We have all kinds of berries, lingonberries. So we do all berries that we can find that grow in the Northwest.
Did you say cajostaberries or
jostaberries? They're like a black currant and a gooseberry mix, cross.
Incredible. I'm so curious to know, and I've actually never asked this of a berry farmer. Sometimes when you get a very big blackberry, when you eat it, first you taste sweet, and then there's this sort of underlying bitterness. Your berries had none of that. What causes it?
You know, I think the core of the blackberry can cause that. And so a lot of our varieties that we choose to grow have not much of a core. And so that way it doesn't taste like that. And then also, berries are like wine. It just depends on the season. If it has a lot of sun, they can be very sweet. And if we haven't had very much sun, they're not as sweet. They don't have as much sugar in it. So Mother Nature plays a lot into how all our berries taste.
I can't imagine that these berries being sweeter than what we tasted today. Bev, how old is the farm?
1875 is when my husband's great-great-great-grandfather got here and started clearing land and being a farmer here.
I mean, as a Southern Californian coming up here, one immediately sees that the role of berries in the Pacific Northwest is completely different than it is where we live. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, you know, I think the climate here is really good for a quality berry. And what we do is we're just a one crop a year kind of thing, whereas California can sometimes do two crops off because of the way their season is. And then since they ship all over, they have to do varieties that can travel. Our berries just can't travel far. Like Skagit Valley berries, you probably will not see on the East Coast. So, because they have a lot of sugar in them. So the shelf life is very short. Same with raspberries. They might not go very far. There are different varieties of raspberries that we grow here, some with less sugar that do travel. So the industry standard, which is the Meeker, are so sweet, I doubt that they ever go to the East Coast. But there's Tulamines and Willamettes that have less sugar in them. You can taste them when you put them in your mouth, and they do have a longer shelf life, so those can travel. And California hasn't quite figured out how to grow those yet. So I believe Washington State is the biggest state for growing raspberries.
It's been wonderful meeting you and tasting these gorgeous berries. Thank you so much.
Yeah, well, thank you. I'm glad you have some interest in Northwest berries and choosing me to visit with you.
That was Bev Lenning. We've been visiting her at her berry stand here at the Mount Vernon Farmers Market. We have a ton of photos from the market on the Good Food blog. Check it out at kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming up next, we visit Seattle, where we find goey duck and discover what happens when you plunge fresh oysters into liquid nitrogen. Stay close.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
Welcome back to Good Food. We're in the Capitol Hill neighborhood of Seattle in front of the Melrose Market, standing with Oyster Bill Whitbeck. It's so exciting to see you.
Well, it's nice to see you.
We've heard so much about Taylor Shellfish that it's really wonderful to actually be able to walk in and see this retail location. But your touching the shellfish starts way before it ends up in a retail space.
Right. Taylor Shellfish is a fifth generation family farm. Started back in the 1800s, and it's evolved into the largest shellfish growing operation in the United States. All these oysters, clams, and mussels that are in the store start in a hatchery. We raise all the shellfish in a hatchery as little babies, and we nurture them and grow them and make sure they get the right food before we plant them out in the bay to grow naturally.
Now, when you say bay, what bay?
Well, we've got over 10,000 acres of tidelands, mostly in South Puget Sound. They grow naturally there. We don't feed them, you know, anything other than what's in the water. They eat algae and phytoplankton. We have a pearl oyster farm in Fiji. So we're all over the place.
We hear so much about quality of water and sustainability, all kinds of ecological issues about where water meets where people live. Your family must have seen ebb and flow, so to speak, of good and bad, everything through the years.
Yeah, I've always felt that shellfish farmers were the first true environmentalists as far as keeping the water clean, because without clean water, we can't work. So we do everything that we have to do to make sure the water stays clean and we grow shellfish that's safe to eat.
Was there a period of time, certain decades or a certain period of years, where it was so hard that you thought it wasn't going to come back again?
Yes. As a matter of fact, the native Olympia oyster, which is the only true native oyster to the West Coast, pretty much was wiped out in the 1920s, 1930s. They're a very fragile little oyster, and that was the only oyster that was growing here. With the influx of pulp mills and the timber industry, a lot of the effluents from these mills pretty much wiped out all those little oysters, the little native Olympias. And through legislation and shutting down some of these mills, the Olympia oyster has made a comeback, and we're a big part of that. The native tribes also ate the Olympia oyster for, you know, thousands of years. So we work very closely with the tribes to try to reintroduce that native species in areas where they grew thousands of years ago. If you had lunch here with the Indians, the native Indians, 5,000 years ago, you would have had the native oysters.
So let's talk about the goey duck for a moment.
Goey duck.
First of all, the name is so bizarre. Gooey, and yet not spelled that way at all.
No, it's one of those misnomers. The word goey duck actually derives from a native Nisqually Indian name, and it was pronounced Gwiduck, Gwiduck, and it means dig deep, and that's what Gwiduck means in native Nisqually. And when the settlers came and they started harvesting Gwiduck, they They didn't know how to spell, so they spelled it G-E-O-D-U-C-K, and that's how the name stuck. But it's the largest burrowing clam in the world. They can live to be 130, 140 years old. We plant the seed as babies out of our hatchery, and we harvest them at about 7 years so that the quality of the meat is very sweet, very tender, than if you go out and dig a clam on your own and get a clam that's 80 or 90 years old.
I had no idea that gooey duck was farmed. No idea.
Well, we were the first to farm gooey duck, and there was quite a big learning curve because nobody had ever done it before, but it's finally paid off.
So I think most of us have a mental image of how clams and mussels and oysters sit out in a farm. Describe to me how you plant the gooey duck and where they stay, where they grow.
Okay. Gooey duck don't have a very exciting life. When they're little babies, about an inch long, we take them out to the beach, and at a low tide, we plant them in the sand, in the gravel sand. We put a PVC pipe down to protect them. We put a netting over the top to keep predators away, ducks and crabs. And then as that gooey duck grows, it digs down, and it gets bigger and digs down deeper and deeper until it finally reaches, in a couple year and a half, 2 years, it reaches the depth that it's going to stay at. Gooey duck only travel down. They don't go side to side. They don't come up. They only travel down. So when that shell of the clam reaches its depth of, you know, 3, 4, 5 feet, the siphon or the neck is actually what extends up, and the tip of that siphon sticks above the sand. So when you go to the beach, you'll see the very tip of the siphon sticking up, and if you stomp your feet or disturb it, that siphon will pull down.
So if we see a gooey duck, for example, in one of your tanks, and the siphon part that is sticking out is about 6 inches long, what is its range of ability once it's in situ to stick its siphon all the way up for some air?
When you go to harvest a gooey duck, you disturb it and the siphon contracts. So when you pull a gooey duck out of the sand, the siphon may only be, you know, 7, 8 inches long. But once it's out of the water and relaxes, like it's in the tanks here, that siphon will extend out to up to 3, 4 feet.
Where else is native habitat for the gooey duck?
Gooey duck only grow in the Pacific Northwest. They don't grow anywhere else in the world. Their habitat is from Southeast Alaska into British Columbia and then down into Puget Sound. There is more biomass of gooey duck in Puget Sound than any other animal. And one of the reasons that they're out there in such big quantities is because they live in very deep water. They live in very shallow water. A lot of shellfish they live in a very narrow band of tidal area, but gooey ducks live everywhere. So there's a lot of gooey duck out there.
Thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you for being here today.
That was Oyster Bill Whitbeck. He's the Seattle area restaurant sales manager for Taylor Shellfish Farms, the largest producer of farm shellfish in the United States. Across the bridge from Seattle, in the city of Bellevue, is Nathan Myhrvold's Modernist Cuisine Lab. You may have heard of the six-volume, almost $600 collection of books called Modernist Cuisine, The Art and Science of Cooking, as well as the more recent, slightly smaller, Modernist Cuisine at Home. Well, this lab in Bellevue is where all that book and all the fascinating science and photography inside it originated. I'm here with Anjana Shankar, research and development chef at the lab, and she's showing us an extraordinary new way to shuck oysters.
We picked up some oysters from Oyster Bill this afternoon, and we have cushy oysters here and shugoku. So we're going to show you how to Cairo shuck oysters in liquid nitrogen. We take the oysters, dip them in liquid nitrogen for 15 seconds, take them out, let them rest for 30 minutes, and they open by themselves, so there's no shell fragments. It's a very clean cut, and it's delicious.
Now, when I think about taking a living being, an oyster, and plunging it into liquid nitrogen, which is minus 320 degrees, I think to myself, what's happening inside that doesn't destroy the quality of the meat?
It releases the connective tissue inside the shell, where compared to shucking an oyster by hand, you damage the oyster by poking it. Sometimes it's so hard to shuck, the knife goes right into the belly of the oyster, so everything gets damaged inside. Here, it's so cold that it's only for 15 seconds. It doesn't damage the oyster, it's intact, and there's no shell fragments on the oyster when you shuck it.
So does the oyster itself just contract so quickly and severely from the cold that that's what breaks the connection?
Connective tissue, yes, it does.
Wow, that's just amazing. And then you have to let it sit for 30 minutes and allow it to come back up to a regular temperature that we can understand.
Yes, where it opens by itself, you'll see a little gap here between the two shells. And then you just have to tip it open and it's there. You don't even have to cut the connective tissue.
Do you think that we're going to get to a point where people are going to have a little nitrogen tank in their home in some sort of consumer-made appliance that would allow us to do things like this?
I hope that is easily accessible in future, but right now you have to have a license to have liquid nitrogen. And some people who are really interested in cooking and molecular gastronomy, they do have liquid nitrogen, and they do store it in these doers. I hope it's easily accessible for future use. You can do a lot with that. And you can even shuck clams, any shellfish, lobster. We do gooey duck. Same method, 15 seconds, and you can just peel off the skin, and it's a clean cut. You're not damaging the shellfish or the clams.
Okay, I can't wait for these guys to sort of get a little warmer and then just weep, pop open. Anjana, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Anjana Shankar is a research and development chef at Nathan Myhrvold's Modernist Cuisine Lab in Bellevue, Washington. There's a video of Anjana cryoshucking oysters and liquid nitrogen on our blog. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com or via iTunes. You can also find good food on demand on KCRW's apps for the iPod, Android, and BlackBerry. Today's program was produced by Jillian Ferguson. A big thanks to Laurel, Sarah, Harriet, Ronnie, and Gary. I'm Evan Kleiman. Join me back here next week for another edition of Good Food.